The drivers were usually wet through when they returned. But life had its compensations. Ord Lees, the expedition's tight-fisted storekeeper, known to the men variously as the Colonel, the Old Lady, the Belly Burglar, the Man of Action, and a host of other derogatory nicknames, decided on November the 12th to move out of Number 5 tent for a while. Worsley, with sarcastic relish, described the reaction in his diary. "Sounds of bitter sobs and lamentations are heard this evening from Number 5 tent at the loss of their dearly beloved Colonel, who has removed himself for a season to sleep in his store in the old wheelhouse. He indulgently yields to our earnest entreaties to continue to dine with us, and comforts us with the assurance that he will return promptly to our humble but happy home immediately we prepare to get on the march." Of all the expedition members, Ord Lees was undoubtedly the strangest, and probably the strongest too. Before joining the expedition, he'd been physical education director of His Majesty's Royal Marines, and he could easily have whipped any of the other 27 men. Yet for all the abuse his crewmates heaped on him, Ord Lees was never provoked into a fight. He would usually reply in a hurt tone of voice, "Now really, you shouldn't say things like that." Still, he was anything but a coward. In fact, he was almost foolhardy in the risks he took. Out seal hunting, he would dash across leads of open water, leaping from one chunk of ice to the next, while killer whales cruised around. Once during the darkest part of the winter, when the Endurance had been beset, he found a bicycle in the hold of the ship and went out for a ride across the frozen floes. He was gone 2 hours in the perilous cold, and a searching party had to go out to find him. When he was brought back to the ship, Shackleton ordered him thereafter never to leave unless he was accompanied by another man, and instructed Worsley to see that he obeyed. Ord Lees had an enigmatic, childlike personality. He was fundamentally lazy, except for a few activities such as skiing, which gave him pleasure. But he was not ashamed of his laziness, and he made no effort to disguise it. Even in the most desperate circumstances, when other men were on the point of collapse from fatigue, he seemed to openly shirk his duty. It was perhaps only his guilelessness about it that made him tolerable to the others. As a storekeeper, however, he was excellent, at least under their meagre circumstances. He suffered from a morbid fear of starving to death, so he was as miserly as possible with their stores. Several times Shackleton reprimanded him for issuing insufficient food. He continually antagonized his tent mates. Frequently, when it was his turn to bring the pot of hoosh from the galley to the tent, he'd get distracted along the way so that the food was cold when it arrived. No amount of pleading, curses, or threats could get him to improve. He saved everything, and his collection of clutter occupied much more space than he was entitled to. With Shackleton, however, he was obsequious, an attitude which Shackleton detested. Shackleton, like almost everybody else, disliked Ord Lees intensely, and even told him so once. Characteristically, Ord Lees dutifully recorded the incident in his diary, writing it in the third person as if he had been an onlooker during the conversation. For all his undesirable traits, however, Ord Lees appeared to be incapable of malice. Most of the men wrote him off as a fool, so that when he was most infuriating, he was also rather ludicrous. Shackleton, who'd been busily studying possible escape routes, announced on November 13th that he had formed a plan. Their drift thus far appeared to be carrying them directly towards Snow Hill Island, about 270 miles to the northwest. It lay off the coast of the Palmer Peninsula and was probably connected to the peninsula by ice. If the pack opened enough to let them launch the boats in time, they might land there. They would then be in a position to travel overland about 150 miles to the west coast of the Palmer Peninsula, eventually arriving at Wilhelmina Bay, a frequent summertime stopping place for whalers. Once contact had been established with the whalers, their rescue would seem assured. Shackleton planned to have a small party of 4 men make the overland journey across the 5,000-foot glaciers of the Palmer Peninsula, while the rest of the party waited at Snow Hill for rescue. There was no assurance that the plan could be put into effect, but even the remotest possibility had to be considered, and exploited to the fullest. Hurley went to work filing down screws and fixing them as cleats into four pairs of boots for the men who might have to climb the glaciers. Shackleton himself pored over every available chart of the region, figuring out the best route. That night, as if to underscore the precariousness of their situation, a noise like distant, muffled thunder rumbled through the pack. A new wave of pressure had begun, and 3,500 yards away, they could see the ice once again attacking the ship. About 9 p.m., they heard the sound of a splintering crack, and looking over, they saw her foremast come crashing down, carrying the blue ensign with it. Chapter 4. Though their flow remained undamaged throughout the pressure, Shackleton, who did not want a full sense of security to develop among the men, issued an emergency stations bill on November 15th. Unlikely as escape was, every man was assigned a specific duty in case the party should suddenly have to strike camp. If their route was to be over the ice, the sledge drivers would harness their teams with all possible speed, while the other men gathered stores and equipment, struck the tents, and then stood by the sledges. Or, if, as they hoped, they could escape by water, they were to ready the boats. But it was impossible to prevent a certain amount of complacency as the men became increasingly accustomed to the well-established day-in, day-out routine of camp life. The line of pale green tents now seemed almost as familiar as the ship had been. Two of the tents were the conventional sort, with a bamboo pole in the center. The others, the hoop tents designed by Marston for the expedition, operated on the same principle as the sunshade on a baby carriage, and they could be set up or struck in a matter of seconds. Their ability to weather storms, however, was not equal to that of the center pole variety. Each day in camp began at 6:30 a.m., when the night watchman drew off a tablespoon of gasoline from a drum in the galley and poured it into a small iron saucer in the bottom of the stove. He then lighted the gasoline, and it in turn ignited strips of blubber draped on grates above the saucer. Hurley had fashioned the stove from an old oil drum and a cast-iron ash chute taken from the ship. The stove sat in the center of the galley, which was itself little more than a makeshift windbreak, constructed of spars driven into the ice, over which pieces of sail had been stretched and lashed in place. The galley also served as the library, and the few books that had been salvaged from the Endurance were kept there in plywood packing cases. In addition, a chronometer hung on one post, a mirror on another. As soon as the stove was burning, the night watchman awakened Green to begin breakfast. By 7 o'clock, the men had begun to emerge from their tents to relieve themselves off behind some nearby hummocks. Many carried frayed toothbrushes, and on their way back, they paused to clean their teeth with snow. The heavy sleepers, who were not up by 7:45, were awakened by the night watchman, who went among the tents shouting, "Lash up and stow!" The men rolled up their sleeping bags and sat down on them to wait for breakfast, sometimes seal steak, sometimes canned fish, sometimes porridge or pemmican and tea. After breakfast, the men went about their customary chores. Green spent the morning making bannocks. These were lumps of fried flour, frequently mixed with dog pemmican or lentils or anything that would give them some flavor, and there was always ice to be melted into water. Old Chippy McNeish, usually assisted by MacLeod, Howe, and Bakewell, spent these days raising the sides of the whaler and one of the cutters to make them as seaworthy as possible. However, they were hampered by a shortage both of tools and of materials. Only a saw, a hammer, a chisel, and an adze had been salvaged, and McNeish had obtained his few nails by pulling them one by one out of the superstructure of the Endurance. Hurley, too, was busy preparing for the boat journey. He was not only an excellent photographer, but a skilled tinsmith as well, and he was now at work fashioning a primitive boat pump from a tube-like portion of the ship's compass binnacle. The rest of the party spent their time hunting. Most of the men went out in pairs to look for seals, while the dog drivers exercised their teams around the floe. Often while they were exercising the dogs, the drivers would see one of the hunting parties in the distance waving a small flag, a signal that a seal had been sighted. One of the teams would then go to bring in the carcass. Killing the seal was usually a bloody business. Wilder brought from the ship a revolver, a 12-gauge shotgun, and a .33 caliber rifle. But ammunition was limited. As a result, the men killed the seals by hand whenever possible. This involved approaching the animal cautiously, then stunning it across the nose with a ski or a broken oar, and cutting its jugular vein so that it bled to death. Sometimes the blood was collected in a vessel to be fed to the dogs, but most often it was allowed to run out into the snow. Another technique was to brain the seal with a pickaxe, but the two surgeons discouraged this practice, for it often left the brains inedible, and they were prized as food because they were believed to be high in vitamin content. In the beginning, a few of the men, particularly little Louis Rickinson, the chief engineer, were squeamish about this seemingly cold-blooded method of hunting. But not for long. The will to survive soon dispelled any hesitancy to obtain food by any means. After lunch, which usually consisted of a bannock or two per man, with some jam and tea, the men went to work strengthening sledge harnesses, repacking equipment, or helping with the boats. The dogs were fed at 5 p.m. amidst a terrific amount of barking, and supper for the men was at 5:30, most often seal hoosh, a bannock, and a mug of hot-watered cocoa. In the evenings, activities varied somewhat from tent to tent. There was the reading aloud in Worsley's tent. In number one, Shackleton's four-man tent, invariably there was a game of poker, patience, or bridge. The seamen and firemen in number four tent also played cards or sat around yarning. The subject of sex was rarely brought up, not because of any post-Victorian prudishness, but simply because the topic was almost completely alien to the conditions of cold, wet, and hunger which occupied everyone's thoughts almost continually. Whenever women were discussed, it was in a nostalgic, sentimental way, of a longing to see a wife, a mother, or a sweetheart at home. The official lights out, a figure of speech, since there was daylight now, nearly 16 hours a day, was at 8:30 p.m. A good many men turned in earlier, after removing their trousers and jerseys, and possibly putting on a pair of dry socks. Nobody ever took off his underwear. Some men stayed up after the official curfew, though they had to talk in subdued voices. In the cold, crisp air, any noise carried an unusually long distance. By 10 p.m., everything was quiet in the camp, except for the lone night watchman patrolling among the tents and keeping an eye on the galley chronometer, which told him when his one-hour tour of duty was over. During these 3 weeks since the Endurance had been abandoned, perhaps the most striking change in the party was their appearance. Some men had always worn beards, and they were now just a little shaggier than before. But faces that had previously been clean-shaven were now covered with a scrubby half-inch growth of whiskers. And everybody's face grew filthy from the blubber smoke. It infiltrated everywhere, clung tenaciously to whatever it touched, and responded poorly to snow and the small amount of soap that could be spared for washing. There were two schools of thought on the matter of cleanliness. Though any overall bathing was out of the question, some men scrubbed their faces in snow whenever the weather permitted. Others purposely let the dirt accumulate on the theory that it would toughen their skin against frostbite. Similarly, the camp was divided on the matter of eating into the savers and the non-savers. Worsley headed the non-savers, who gobbled down anything they could get, whenever they could get it. Ord Lees, with his all-consuming fear of starving to death, was the leading advocate of the savers' school of thought. He rarely ate his entire ration at any meal. Instead, he stored a little piece of cheese or a bit of bannock somewhere in his clothing to be eaten later, or saved for the leaner days he was sure would come. He could and often did produce from his pocket a lump of food that had been issued a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks before. But there was no shortage of food these days. Obliging animals ever presented themselves in camp. On November 18th, a woebegone little seal, scarcely a month old, wandered in amongst the tents. He had apparently lost his mother to a killer whale, and though he was so small that he was almost worthless as food, the men reluctantly killed him anyhow, since he obviously could not survive alone. On the 19th, pandemonium among the dogs announced the presence of a seal in camp, this time a big bull crab-eater. After several such appearances, Worsley advanced the theory that whenever seals sighted the camp, they mistook it for land or a rookery and headed straight toward it.